Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Before starting, I would like to welcome any and all new listeners to our podcast and urge them to check out our archives, where we have a wide range of topics and guests. Some of my personal favorites can be found highlighted at the top of our webpage, www.researchonreligion.org. But I can also assure you that you will undoubtedly find many topics that interest you in our extensive archive, currently over 70 interviews. Also, please give us a like at our Facebook page, Research on Religion with Anthony Gill. If you are a Facebooker, you can join that page by clicking on the Facebook icon on the right-hand column of our main webpage. And please help us spread the word by using our social media links found below each episode. You can Facebook, Twitter, Digit, Reddit, and even just plain old email your friends about this wonderful, free resource. We have heard that a number of pastors and homeschoolers listen in every week, and we believe that the general public will enjoy our podcast on a regular basis. So please, give us a shout-out if you enjoy the program. I encourage you to check out our sponsoring organization as well, the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University, www.isreligion.org. Okay, on with the show. A few weeks back, we featured Douglas Baker discussing prejudice against evangelical Christians by secular authors who were concerned that presidential candidates such as Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry were part of a larger conspiracy of religiously motivated politicians seeking to craft a theocratic rule over the United States. Today, we turn to another manifestation of religious prejudice that has been dogging a different candidate, Mitt Romney, in the 2012 presidential race, that being anti-Mormonism. Whereas the critique of dominionism leveled against Bachmann and Perry has been relatively new, hostility, both verbal and physical, towards the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has deep roots in American history, dating back to the initial founding of the religion in upstate New York in the 1820s. Indeed, Mormons, as members of the Latter-day Saints have become known as, were forcefully chased westward throughout the 1800s by communities that considered them to be a threat to the moral and religious fabric of the United States. Their diaspora to the Great Basin and their headquarters in Salt Lake City parallels the nation's history of westward expansion. And what is more, the founder of the LDS Church, Joseph Smith, experienced being tarred and feathered for his beliefs and was eventually killed by a mob that raided a jail cell he had been imprisoned in on charges of destroying a printing press and treason against the state of Illinois. In contemporary times, physical attacks against Mormons have been much less common, at least here in the United States. Nonetheless, rhetorical criticism still persists, with the likes of televangelist Bill Keller publicly declaring that he would never vote for a Mormon, an attack that he specifically levied against Mitt Romney. Where does this sometimes fervent hatred of the Latter-day Saints come from? Why has it persisted over time? And will it be a factor in the upcoming presidential race? To help us gain insight on these questions, I'm pleased to be joined today by Professor Patrick Mason, an associate professor of American religion and the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at the Claremont Graduate University. Professor Mason, who most recently was conducting research at the University of Notre Dame, is the recent author of The Mormon Menace, Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South. Patrick, welcome to Research on Religion.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tony.
Now, I just know that you hold the Howard W. Hunter Chair in Mormon Studies at Claremont. Tell us a little bit about what that position is.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's really a unique program in the country in terms of a program dedicated to Mormon studies. The idea originated here a few years ago at Claremont Graduate University, specifically in the School of Religion, that we could develop a series of councils that would include members of the community, members of various religious traditions in the community. We're located here in Southern California, not too far from Los Angeles, and it's one of the most religiously diverse places in the country, if not the world. And so the idea was to have better relations and interface with some of the various religious communities in the area. And so the School of Religions set up a series of councils that included there's a Protestant council, a Catholic council, a Mormon council, a Muslim council, a Zoroastrian council, a Coptic council, so a Jewish council. So some of the major religious traditions represented here in the area. And the arrangement was such that there would be classes taught in each of these areas, but also if the communities were able to raise enough money to fund an endowed chair, then it would be placed here at the School of Religion. So the Latter-day Saint Council has been really active in fundraising in recent years, and they were able to raise enough money for an endowed chair. So the program was officially kicked off about 3 years ago. Richard Bushman, who's a distinguished historian, retired from Columbia University, he came as the inaugural chair, although he understood that he'd be temporary because he was already retired. And so I took the position this year as the first permanent chair, the Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies.
Now, it's not like a curse chair that you're going to be required to retire pretty soon, right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind early retirement, but I've still got a long career ahead of me.
So. That's good. The other thing about chairs, we talk about endowed chairs at universities and such, and I'm never going to have one of these things, but I've always got this question. Does the actual endowed chair come with a chair, the four legs and all, and does it have a little nameplate on it?
Yeah, I was actually a little surprised to walk into the office, and there is an actual chair that says the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies. The thing is, I'm not quite sure if I'm supposed to sit on it or if it's purely decorative. That's still up in the air, but there is an actual physical chair.
Seriously, that is really interesting. Are you sitting in it now?
I'm not, because I'm not sure what the policy is.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in a regular office chair right now, and it's sitting in a very stately place to my side.
All right. Well, enough of that silly chair talk here. Our topic today is a little bit more serious, and it deals with anti-Mormonism. And I teased our listeners in the introduction with a promise that we would get around to talking about Mitt Romney. And I guess also John Huntsman, too, who's another Mormon who is in the 2012 presidential race, but probably not a big factor. And I do want to carve some time out at the end of our interview to talk about that. However, your work as a historian really takes us deeper than contemporary screeds against the LDS Church, and I feel that's probably pretty important to understand the historical background of anti-Mormonism in the United States to give us a better context for what folks like Bill Keller might be saying today. And now, there is one thing that I should note about my introduction to you. I mentioned that you wrote a book called The Mormon Menace. The subtitle of that book is interesting in many ways, and I don't know if our listeners caught on to what initially puzzled me about that subtitle when I first saw the book. And the subtitle is Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South. Now, I've been doing some reading on Mormon history ever since Romney threw his hat into the presidential ring back in 2007. And most of what I have read deals with the exodus of Mormons from Palmyra, New York, through Ohio and Illinois, and then out to present-day Utah, maybe scattering a little bit into Montana, Nevada, and even Minnesota, and a few other places like that. Rarely do we think of a Mormon presence south of the Mason-Dixon line. What can you tell us about the movement of Mormons westward, and more particularly southward, in the middle part of the 19th century?
Sure. It's a great question, and people, I think, sometimes are a little bit surprised that my story takes place in the South. Of course, the main narrative of Mormon history has been one of westward expansion, that the religion gets its start in the 1820s and early 1830s in New York with Joseph Smith, and then he moves with his followers to Ohio, to Missouri, to Illinois, and then after Joseph Smith's death in 1844, Brigham Young leads the main body of the Latter-day Saints west to Utah. Of course, many remain in the Midwest and create later on the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is now the Community of Christ, and a few other groups. But the main story, especially as we look in not only textbooks in American religious history, but most of the scholarship that's been done on Mormonism, has been done on these main population centers from Ohio to Missouri to Illinois to Utah. And, of course, that's a crucial story to tell. That's an important story to tell, maybe even the central story to tell. But there are other stories as well. And I was interested in looking at what happens when Mormons are in another place where they are clearly the minority. In Utah, they were the overwhelming majority, and that creates a very interesting dynamic where they're the minority religion in the country, but the majority religion in the region and in the territory. But I wanted to look at what happens when Mormons are somewhere else, and I was particularly interested in some of the intersections. Thematically, I'm interested as a historian in themes, not only religion, but also race and violence. So I was interested in the late 19th century South, knowing that it was such a violent place, and I wanted to see what happens when Mormons are there. I knew at the outset of my research that there was some Mormon presence there, but I didn't know that much about it, and there wasn't much, if any, literature on the presence of Mormons in the South. So that was sort of the story I wanted to tell. And mostly, there was an antebellum presence of Mormons in the South. Mormons did send missionaries to the southern states in the 1830s and 1840s, but it was a pretty minuscule community. Many of those saints gathered with the other saints as they moved west. So there were a few left over in the South, but really not much of a community to speak of. And Mormons pulled their missionaries from the South during the Civil War and in the early years of Reconstruction. So really my story picks up in about 1875 when they reconstitute a mission to the southern states, start sending missionaries back, start rebuilding a membership there. And so I wanted to trace what happens in the last quarter of the 19th century as they build a new community in the South.
Yeah, that's one question I had a little bit about the antebellum South, in that Mormonism is a northern religion founded in New York. And so I would expect that it is very much anti-slavery. And so that must have been a hard sell going down to the South in the 1830s and 1840s as not only a different religion from, say, the Baptist South, but also one that was associated with anti-slavery.
Right. And slavery was a bone of contention for the Latter-day Saints in the antebellum period, particularly as they settled in Missouri. Because you're right, most of the Mormon converts, not all, but most of them came from northern states or from England or from Canada. And so they had, even if they weren't, on the forefront of the movement for racial equality, they generally had an anti-slavery sensibility. And so when they settle in Missouri, and of course we know all the political contention over Missouri as a slave state, and some of they're part of this history, and they're right in the middle of this. And many of the other settlers, the non-Mormon settlers in Missouri, especially in western Missouri where they are Southerners and who are pro-slavery. And so you do have immediately this cultural contention between the Mormons and the non-Mormons. There are other issues as well in terms of politics, control of local politics, their orientation towards Native Americans that are right on the line of Indian territory. So there's lots of other issues as well, but slavery is one of them. And Mormons have a bit of in the 1830s, there's some division in terms of how do we treat the slavery question. Originally, there was a sense that, well, we'll preach to slaves and we're basically against slavery, although, it would be a stretch to say that they were radical abolitionists by any stretch. But then, given the fierceness of the reaction against that by Southern settlers and others, they kind of backed off of that conviction and said, okay, we won't preach to slaves, and they tried to mute that part of difference between them and the non-Mormon settlers. Of course, as they moved to Utah, it became less of an issue, but actually, we sometimes forget that the Utah Territory becomes part of the United States only after the Mexican-American War, and as part of the Compromise of 1850, Utah is constituted as a slave territory, and slavery is legal in Utah. The Mormons do there are African-Americans who are part of the first pioneer company to Utah, And there is slavery in Utah, alongside there are free blacks as well. But Utah is a slave territory. It's never very prosperous. It's not a major site for slavery. But it is part of the early history of Mormons that we sometimes forget about.
And that's fascinating. I had not recalled that Utah was considered to be a slave state. I usually associate it with it coming much later in the Union. But you're right, 1850, this is definitely before the Civil War. And I'm I wanted to ask this question. I'm not a theologian, a Mormon theologian by any stretch of the means, but it has always appeared to me that Mormonism tends to be a rather inclusionary theology, in part because, you know, it talks about how Christ appeared here in the Americas,
right,
and that it's welcoming to the indigenous population, the Native Americans or the Indians. And so I would seem that that would have some impact on how they related to the Indians and possibly also to African-American slaves around this period of time. Did that cause any conflict in the South?
Yeah, the issue with Native Americans is fascinating because you're right. The Book of Mormon does present itself as a history of really of Christian origins in America. And the center point of the Book of Mormon is when Jesus Christ, after his resurrection in Jerusalem, he actually makes an appearance here in the Americas. It tells the tale of a Christian society here. And there are prophecies about the importance of the native peoples of North and South America as part of the Mormon millennial scheme. And so Mormons, especially theologically and in an ideal sense, had a very progressive and enlightened view of Native Americans because they saw them as essential to this cosmic narrative that they constructed. Now, when they actually get to Utah, reality is always a little different than the ideal. And of course, they're competing for the same land. The Indians were there first. And when Mormons get there, they're competing for land, they're competing for scarce resources, they're in the middle of the desert. So there is conflict, there's violence between the two groups. But there's also, there's always still a push towards the ideal as well. Brigham Young encourages some missionaries to intermarry with Native Americans. And even the laws, I've done some research on laws against interracial marriage and interracial sex in Utah, and it's interesting that they never pass a law against interracial marriage with Native Americans, whereas other Western states do. So it is an interesting way in which theology, a unique theology, dictates social and cultural interactions. Of course, by the post-bellum period, most of the Native Americans have been pushed out of the South. That's far less of an issue than it is with African Americans, and Mormons had a fraught relationship with African Americans, to be generous, frankly. And even though during Joseph Smith's lifetime, African Americans were included, although there were never more than really a few that were part of the movement. They were included. African American men were given the priesthood as part of the universal priesthood for men. But that practice changes in the 1850s, and African Americans are barred from the priesthood, barred from temple ordinances into the late 1970s when that practice is overturned. So it is interesting. On the one hand, Mormons have a very kind of progressive theology toward Native Americans, but then on the other hand, with African Americans, their practice mirrors much of what other American Protestants and other American Christians are doing in terms of excluding them or otherwise creating segregated religious systems that don't get turned over until the mid to late 20th century.
What was the reason for that change to exclude African Americans from the priesthood?
Well, the historians still debate about this a little bit. It's the origins of the ban, of the practice on banning blacks from the priesthood are still a little bit murky. But the general consensus of historians, like I say, we have very rich documentation that African Americans are given the priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime. And are sent on missions or are official representatives of the religion. So that's well-established fact. And the practice does seem to change when they get to Utah right around 1850, 1852, sometime in the very early 1850s. And it seems, the general consensus, and I agree with this, is that in essence Mormons capitulate to the broader racist ideologies of the United States at the time. And of course, they're able to find theological resources for this, not only in the Bible, as other Christians did, but also in Mormonism's unique scriptures, particularly some passages in what's called the Pearl of Great Price in the Book of Abraham that they used to support the ban on the priesthood for any descendants of the African race. And so they find sources and texts that support this, but that clearly wasn't part of how Joseph Smith interpreted those passages when he first related them to the saints. And so it is an organic process of evolution, of theological evolution, although I contend, and many others contend, that there never is a revelation, per se, that establishes this as part of church doctrine, that it evolves more as a practice stemming from a broader racist ideology that pervades Mormons. They're a lot like other white Americans on this front, and then they find particular LDS content to support their views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in many ways we're products of our culture.
Of course.
Let me ask you about the South, since you talked about that, and we just return back to the postbellum South. How prevalent was Mormonism in the South? Was this, 20%, 5%, less than 1%? How many folks were down there?
Well, it's really quite minuscule, actually. I mean, by the time, as I said, the Mormons don't send missionaries there during the Civil War, during Reconstruction. They reconstitute the mission in 1875 and start sending missionaries there. And for most of the late 1870s and 1880s, we're talking about a few dozen missionaries. I mean, it's a relatively active missionary force, but it's not a cast of hundreds or thousands, certainly. And it is a productive mission field, but in the late 19th century, the idea was Mormon converts were encouraged to gather to the central gathering place of the Latter-day Saints, which at the time was in Utah. And so converts, when they joined the church, they were encouraged to pick up their families and leave rather than stay in their local areas. Now, but from what I can tell, the best I can tell from the data is that about 40% of the Mormon converts in the South, give or take, moved west. And so what that means is that even given that it's a relatively productive field, there isn't a huge Latter-day Saint community because about half of them are leaving as soon as they join the church. So even by the late 1880s and 1890s, we're talking about a total Latter-day Saint community in the South of about 1,200 to 1,500 total. And so this is really minuscule. So on the one hand, you say, well, this is a tiny little community. How can it be of any historical importance? But given the depth of feeling against them, the animosity, and then as that translates into violence, that really sort of gave me the clue to say, well, this is clearly disproportionate to their numbers or certainly influence. They don't have any political influence or anything like that. So what is going on here that a tiny little community invites and receives so much opposition and violence?
Yeah, I'd like you to go through just an instance of this anti-Mormonism as it takes a very violent turn. You open your book with something known as the Cane Creek Massacre, and it's a very well-told story, this visualization of what is going on and how anti-Mormonism really manifests itself in the South. And I think you make a very good point here that, despite the fact that it was only 1,200, 1,500 or so individuals down there, the level of hatred, the level of bigotry that was expressed against Mormons was immense. So if you could detail for us what the Cane Creek Massacre was all about.
Yeah, Cane Creek is a really interesting story. It takes place in Tennessee in 1884, the summer of 1884. And Cane Creek is a tiny little hamlet in northwestern Tennessee. It's a long way from any major population centers, and in fact, that's telling because Mormon missionaries spent most of their time in rural areas. They were actually sort of intimidated by going to the cities. And the central figure here is a guy named John Gibbs. He was a Welsh convert to Mormonism, had settled in northern Utah, had a wife and three children before being called on a mission to the South. And he spent most of his time in northwestern Tennessee, and by all accounts, he was a very effective missionary, had lots of converts. He had a reputation as a terrific preacher, a very powerful preacher, and he quickly kind of rose through the ranks and became a real leader within the Mormon community in Tennessee. And, of course, those who were opposed to Mormonism took note of this as well. And as early as May 1884, Gibbs comes one day to Cane Creek to preach, and there was enough of a community there where they had built a log meeting house. And he had come expecting to find this new meeting house and to preach on a Sunday morning, and instead he finds a pile of ashes and a note from anti-Mormons essentially saying, get out of here. We don't want you preaching here anymore. If we have to, we'll cause war, they said.
Yeah, that can't be good.
Yeah, Gibbs preaches anyway, and stirs up even more opposition, and the opposition builds during the summer of 1884, and the other Mormon missionaries in the area report increased persecution, increased opposition, and it climaxes in August of 1884, August 10th, actually. The Gibbs and a few other missionaries are there in Cane Creek at a member's home, a convert's home, and they're about to start Sunday services. Gibbs is flipping through the Bible, preparing for his sermon, when about a dozen masked men burst through the woods, they're armed with rifles and other guns, and attack this small party of Mormons that's gathered for a Sunday service. Because they're at this member's home, he calls on his sons to grab their guns to defend the missionaries, and the shooting ensues on both sides. The Mormons are overwhelmed, they're outgunned, and by the time the dust settles and all the shots are fired, five people are killed, four Mormons, the two sons of the convert, their names were Martin and J.R., and then two missionaries, Elder Gibbs and William Berry as well. And then the leader of the mob, actually, of this small mob of about a dozen men, he's killed in the melee as well. So, and immediately after Cane Creek, it's interesting not only in this tragic episode of five people being killed in this fracas, but also immediately after the vigilantes essentially take over the two or three county area. Local law enforcement is powerless to stop them. It's really quite weak in the rural South, especially in this area. The governor has no interest in enforcing the law. And so vigilantes take over, and they drive out all the other Mormons who are in these counties. Two or three dozen Mormons are driven out of their homes. They're forced to sell their homes, their businesses at far below market value. Some of them renounce their faith, so they're able to stay. And so you've got 25, 30 people who are pushed out of the area and forced to move. They eventually migrate west. But it's really a remarkable story. We don't think of this as the way that religions interact in America, but there's this really violent moment, and it's not the only other one, but it's one of the most dramatic scenes.
Yeah, and again, the point being that there are so few Mormons in the area. Why should anybody really be getting upset about this? It's not like they're making huge inroads.
Right.
They get some converts, and as you said, 40% of them pick up and move west. And so that doesn't seem to be a big deal. So for me, the interesting question is, what is the basis for this religious intolerance?
Right. That's always been a question, and Mormons themselves have always been a bit befuddled about this, I think sometimes naively. And the opposition to Mormonism, as you said in your introduction, it goes right back to the origins of the religion. As soon as Joseph Smith proclaims a new religion and translates the Book of Mormon, publishes it in 1830, as soon as you have Mormonism, you have anti-Mormonism. And to some degree, we shouldn't be too surprised about this. I mean, Mormonism did make religious and theological claims that really flew in the face of traditional Orthodox Christianity, talking about angels and new revelation, new scripture, the prophet, new prophets and apostles on the earth. And to some degree, these are challenging religious ideas, and especially as Joseph Smith's theology develops into the early 1840s before he's killed, he really is treading on some ground that is quite challenging towards Orthodox Christianity. And a lot of, Bill Keller and others who say they would never vote for a Mormon or Mormons are fundamentally unchristian and other things, they point especially to some of these later theological developments within Mormonism, for instance, about the humans can become gods, that there are multiple worlds. People question whether or not Mormons are really Christian, whether or not Jesus Christ is really the center point of the religion. So there are all these, and what's the role of the Bible? Is the Bible diminished because of other Mormon scriptures like the Book of Mormon? So there are lots of genuine and in many ways legitimate theological concerns. But I argue in the book, and I feel pretty strongly about this, that people don't kill Mormons because Mormons read the Book of Mormon. People don't kill Mormons because of the identity of their Christology. that they may not like them, that they may say they're wrong, but I think that's a perfectly legitimate response as you have competition between different religions and in the broader religious marketplace. So I think a kind of reaction to Mormon theology is warranted, even to some degree, as the different faiths compete. But where you really get where it gets really serious, and where I think it becomes violent, and where you see legislation and other really strong responses to Mormonism are the social and political manifestations of Mormonism. And in the 1830s and 1840s, Mormons create not only religious communities but political communities. And Nauvoo, Illinois is a Mormon, essentially a little Mormon city-state. And Joseph Smith has enormous political power. He actually throws his hat in the ring as president in the 1844 presidential race. He doesn't have much of a shot in 1844, but it's interesting. And a lot of people say this is not just a religious movement, but there's something deeply unsettling about this, and people say that they're essentially un-American. And then you get another layer. So you have the theological, you have the social and political, but then the final layer, and really what becomes central in my book, in the Postbellum South, is polygamy, which Joseph Smith is sort of experimenting with and secretly institutes in Illinois in the 1840s, but then which becomes a publicly announced as a doctrine and practice of the church in the 1850s. And polygamy really cinches it in terms of a national anti-Mormon campaign.
Yeah, let me hold you back right there, and I want to come back to the issue of polygamy, because that is an important theme, and that does run through much of your book. As you were talking, and you were talking about the rise of this new religion and the new theology and the new Christology, I couldn't help to think about Catholics, and that they were an older theology, and yet they were coming in the 1840s and 1850s as well. And they received a lot of the same hostility. So this isn't just Mormons that's going on at the same time. This is somehow situated in this context. And again, it's, well, those Catholics, they believe in some weird thing, transubstantiation,
right,
or there might be political concerns that are prevalent at the time, is when you get a flood of Irish immigrants coming into Boston, all of a sudden they carry a lot of political clout, and people who've been established there for a long time go, maybe I'm not as well situated in the political realm as I once used to be. So I think there's a similar thing going on as the country changes and it becomes more pluralistic over time.
Right, and I think you're exactly right. I think there's a lot of parallels with the 19th century experience between Catholics and Mormons, and some of the same issues. It's religious, it's political, it's cultural. Of course, Catholics don't have polygamy, but there are lots of sexual concerns about Catholicism in terms of priestly celibacy and nuns, and there's all kinds of salacious rumors and stories about what's happening in nunneries, and there's the Maria Monk case, and so there's a sexual aspect to it as well, a deeply gendered aspect to anti-Catholicism, just as there is to anti-Mormonism. And I think we see there's a lot of parallels, frankly, today with anti-Islamic feeling in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere. So some of these patterns, and in fact some of the language, just gets picked up and replicated. I mean, you can just, you know, fill in the blank, Catholic, Mormon, Islam, for some of these tropes of the religious other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does. And a lot of those similarities cross the boundaries of different religions, because they are just a threat. But as you mentioned, that Mormonism, it was really specifically about this polygamy, or that at least part of the trope or the story that is told and that motivates people to undertake violence is this issue of polygamy. And I think for a lot of people, there's some misunderstandings and confusion about the issue of polygamy in the Latter-day Saints Church. So give us a little bit of background of where this all comes from and how it ends and what it all means.
Right. It really comes out of this sense that Joseph Smith felt that he was not so much creating a new religious tradition as restoring ancient religious traditions, restoring ancient Christianity or ancient religion. And Mormonism, really comes draws deeply not only from New Testament Christianity but also from the Old Testament and ancient Hebrew religion. And so as Joseph Smith went through and was trying to restore this ancient religion, at least in his mind, that's what he was doing. He's not looking just at New Testament precedents, although those are important, but he's also looking at the Old Testament, and he sees there are these precedents of polygamy in the Old Testament, from the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, on down to David and Solomon. And the evidence shows that early in the 1830s, Joseph Smith receives revelations about reinstituting this ancient practice of polygamy, or usually Mormons call it plural marriage or celestial marriage. And as I said, Joseph Smith kind of secretly experiments with it, dabbles with it in the 1830s, but it really becomes comes to the forefront in Nauvoo, Illinois, in the early 1840s, and it's one of the reasons that he tries to keep it secret and introduces it to a small, select group of followers that are really only a few dozen people who even know about it officially in Nauvoo in the 1840s, but it leaks out. There's all kinds of rumors flying around. It's one of the reasons for violence against Joseph Smith, both in Ohio and then in Illinois. It's one of the things that contributes ultimately to his death. But it is, although he's developing this theology and even publishes or writes out a revelation which later becomes published, it's mostly secret during Joseph Smith's lifetime, although he did practice it and he had quite a few plural wives, in addition to his first wife, Emma. And it becomes public, like I say, it's secret during all this time, but it's not until the Latter-day Saints move west under Brigham Young that they announce it publicly. And it's announced publicly in 1852. It becomes really, from 1852 to 1890, it is really a central tenet of Mormonism. It's not the only one, and there are other important aspects of Mormonism, other distinctive elements of it, but it is really, it becomes the primary identity marker. It becomes the primary area of what distinguishes Latter-day Saints from others. And of course, others look at it that way, but Latter-day Saints do as well. And even those who don't practice it, the majority of Latter-day Saints never practice it. It's sort of like slavery in the South. The majority of Southerners never practice slavery, even though they support the practice. And the same is true of plural marriage. The majority of Latter-day Saints don't actually practice it, but they do believe in it. It becomes part of the theology of late 19th century Mormonism and is really central as a theological concept and as a social, and there are political ramifications of it as well. And it lasts until 1890. There's enormous pressure against polygamy. It becomes a platform. One of the original planks of the Republican Party platform is to eliminate the twin relics of barbarism, slavery, and polygamy. And so it's actually an official part and becomes an important part of national politics in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. That's an important part of the story I tell in my book. And until finally, the president of the LDS Church, Wilford Woodruff is his name, issues what's called a manifesto in 1890 in which he officially abandons the practice. Interestingly, he doesn't touch the theology behind it. He doesn't say anything about that. He simply suspends the practice. And it continues for a few years in an underground manner, and then it's really cut off. There's a second manifesto that's issued in 1904 that really cuts it off, and actually at that point the LDS Church excommunicates anybody who continues to practice it, and that's been in force ever since. So for the past more than a century, the past 107 years, the LDS Church has taken a really strong stand against polygamy and actually excommunicates and disciplines anyone who practices or preaches it. But it was a really important part of LDS identity and theology in the late 19th century.
You know, one can understand, at least from my vantage point as a political economist, why this was, one, not a widespread practice among Mormons, and number two, wasn't very popular,
right,
is because in order to make this work, you would have to have a really skewed distribution of women to men.
Yeah.
Right, if you're taking on three or four wives, well, then you better have three or four times as many women as men, so that all men can have a spouse. And so, I mean, just, you know, we know sociologically that women tend to convert to religions quicker and first before men.
Right.
So you're likely to have more women in A New Face than men, but not to the degree that it would
not
make
3-to-1 or 4-to-1.
Yeah, it wouldn't make polygamy feasible. And then in terms of this, and you know, returning to the South and where this bigotry comes from, you hear this stuff about polygamy, you say, wow, these guys are coming in, they're taking multiple wives. If they're taking multiple wives, that means there's one less spouse or mate for me. And one could just see that some guys are going to get livid about this.
Well, and that really is the central part of my argument in the book, is that this violence against Mormons in the South, and I documented over 300 cases of violence against Mormons in the South from 1875 to 1900. Interestingly, far more violence against Mormons numerically than violence against Jews or Catholics in the region, which surprised me. So there's all this violence against Mormons in the South, and in addition to all the rhetoric, very heated rhetoric, and a strong anti-Mormon campaign legislatively, all the religious denominations are firmly against it. So it cuts across the board, and I argue that it's not because of theology, strictly speaking. It's not just because Mormons read the Book of Mormon, or even because they believe in polygamy. It's because they practice it, and it's the fear of this social practice, and it becomes a kind of perfect storm in the postbellum South, in that you have to remember, in the late 19th century South, Southerners have just gone through the chaos and tragedy of the Civil War. They've just gone through Reconstruction, where you had a military occupation of the entire South as late as 1877 in some places. And so they're wary of outsiders. They're wary of carpetbaggers and these religious outsiders, as well as political outsiders. So you have that dynamic. And then you have these guys, these Mormons coming in, not only preaching unpopular doctrines, but everybody knows and equates in the late 19th century Mormonism with polygamy. And so the idea is, when they come in, they're stealing our women, they're taking them back to Utah, where they're going to join their polygamous harems. This is the kind of language they use. They're going to make sexual slaves out of them. And in the late 19th century South, the very thing that defined Southern manhood was the protection of womanhood. And especially this elevation, this celebration, almost near obsession and worship of white womanhood. It's one of the reasons that leads to lynching, a lynching epidemic in the late 19th century against African Americans, because there's this view, wrongly held, but powerful nonetheless, of the black beast rapist, that these African Americans, now that they're freed, they're roaming the countryside at will, just raping white women. Of course, it wasn't actually the case, but it is a powerful myth. And the same thing was true with Mormon missionaries. They come to the South, they're stealing our women, they're taking them back to their polygamous harems, and we have to defend our communities, our families, our women against this unwelcome intrusion. So it's not just that they have religious ideas, but they're actually violating the fundamental norms which uphold Southern society.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just the fundamental norms of Southern society, and you make a very good case in your book that this is about the protection of white womanhood, but it also takes on this anti-American tinge, or that it's seen as anti-American. And that really also comes to the fore, too, when you have the Mountain Meadows Massacre occurring, that it seems that it's this outside religious group now taking on a fight with the American authorities, essentially. Tell us a little bit about this anti-Americanism tinge to critiques of Mormonism, as well as to the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Yeah, from the very beginning, especially once Joseph Smith's theology developed in the late 1830s and 1840s, people point to it as this is not really American. This is anti-democratic. It became very hierarchical. Joseph Smith talked a lot about priesthood and priests and even ideas of the kingdom of God. And it wasn't just a kind of metaphorical spiritual kingdom of God, but a political kingdom of God that would replace and have more authority over the nations of the earth.
Which in many ways gels with a lot of the anti-Catholicism at the time,
absolutely,
too.
I mean, there are a lot of parallels here. And the Mormons were millennialists, especially. They're very strong millennialists. And they believe that this political kingdom of God, the second coming of Christ, is imminent. It's going to happen in their lifetime. It's going to happen in the mid to late 19th century. And so they believe they're preparing this kingdom of God politically, not just spiritually, in anticipation of this. And again, Nauvoo, Illinois is a little city state, and they have a very large militia. And then when they move to Utah, they're moving outside the United States. They're moving into Mexican territory. They want to leave the United States. They want to create their own religious principality. As people often use the word theocracy. And even once they become a territory of the United States, Brigham Young is not only president of the LDS Church, but he's also governor of the territory. So you have religious and political authority wedded in one person, and people see this as fundamentally anti-American and anti-democratic. And so there's a strong political element as well. The Mormonism is tyrannical, it's hierarchical, people just follow what their leaders say, they can't think for themselves. There's a strong element to this. And then you get, as you say, the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 1857. And of course, this is in a context of what we know as the Utah War, where federal troops are literally marching on Utah while this happens. So Mormons have a siege mentality about this. They're very suspicious of outsiders. And then this company of emigrants comes through because, of course, Utah was, everybody had to pass through Utah on their way to the West, whether to Oregon or to California. And this company of emigrants comes through southern Utah, and it's a complicated story in itself. But 120 men, women, and children are killed in cold blood. And even though Mormons try to sort of pass off guilt onto Indians, most people suspect Mormons did it. And so there's a very real competition politically, and there's violence on both sides. And the feeling that Mormons, they're not part of us, they're not part of our political community, and they can't be part of our political community as long as they give obedience to a prophet who speaks for God rather than being part of this democratic body politic.
That, you know, for me is really interesting, and this is going to kind of jettison our conversation forward and what happens in the 20th century. So, you know, one can understand the siege mentality that the Latter-day Saints had. I mean, from the outset, they were basically chased westward.
Right. There were good reasons for them feeling the way they did.
And for me, that's always been very fascinating because today, and again, I'm going to jettison us up to the present here. Today, if you need to look for one of the most patriotic communities in America, you go to Utah. It's Mormons who are devoutly patriotic. And that has always, you know, been of a great interest to me. And one of the things that I find, I teach in Washington, so we're within the sphere of where a lot of Mormons live. And I get a number of Mormon students, many of them who go on to work in the State Department, in part because they have incredible language skills and 2 years of experience in some foreign country, and doing so enthusiastically. And I've always scratched my head about that if I was chased westward and shot at and people were lynching me and upset with me, I don't know. My feelings for the country would be a little bit different. What do you think explains this?
It is a fascinating story. I think it's, and we have some excellent scholarship on this, but we need more. I think it's one of the very interesting stories, not just in American religious history, but in American history. How is this persecuted group, and Mormons really are public enemy number one, especially in the 1880s, in the United States. I mean, presidents are, not only is there legislation against them, a series of anti-polygamy legislation that's clearly targeting them, but in every single State of the Union address and in presidential inaugural addresses, they're talking about the threat of the Mormons and how we need to get rid of the Mormons. I mean, it really pervades every level of American society. It's part of our foreign policy. Rutherford Hayes' administration sends a letter to European governments asking them not to stop Mormon immigrants from coming to the United States. So it becomes part of our foreign policy as well. It's hard for us to think about the depth of how hated Mormons are, how vilified they are in the late 19th century. And then it all changes. It all changes very quickly. Mormons give up polygamy in 1890. They give up their unique political practices and join essentially the national political parties. They gain statehood in 1896. And internally, Mormon leadership makes a very concerted effort to accommodate to the broader cultural and political patterns and to some degree even religious patterns within American society. They fight patriotically and enthusiastically in the Spanish-American War in 1898. I mean, just 10 years earlier, you had federal troops, federal marshals, roving around Utah arresting Mormon leadership for polygamy, and now in 1898, Mormons are putting their hands over their heart and sending their sons to fight and die for the flag. I mean, it's this remarkable transition, and that path only becomes more intense, that path of intense loyalty and dedication to the nation and to the country and to these democratic ideals just picks up speed in the 20th century to the point that a very prominent Mormon leader, he becomes president of the church, his name is Ezra Taft Benson. He's Secretary of Agriculture under Dwight Eisenhower. He becomes a fervent anti-communist. He trumpets America as the providential role of America in the world. And this is part of Mormon theology even from the beginning. There is this tension in Mormon theology that Joseph Smith gives us, that on the one hand, America is chosen. There is a providential role. This is where Jesus came in the Book of Mormon.
It's the new Zion, right?
On the other hand, we're setting up a kingdom of God that's going to overthrow all the nations. So there's this paradox and tension in American in Mormon theology. And in the 20th century, the first part has been emphasized of America as chosen, and the latter part of Mormonism as a distinctive kingdom of God in a political sense has been muted almost to the point where it would be unrecognizable to most Mormons today.
And so this brings up this issue of the current presidential election in 2012.
Yeah.
That Mitt Romney runs, and you could date this back to 2007 when he first threw his hat in the ring. You start to hear these rumblings about the Mormon question. Romney gives a speech regarding this and talks about American pluralism, which I actually think is one of the great speeches on religious pluralism given by a political actor, and it goes highly unnoticed.
Sort of his Kennedy moment.
His Kennedy moment, exactly. But what fascinates me about this is that you've had 100 years or more of this patriotic Mormonism. They're fighting beside one another. You mentioned Benson and the Eisenhower administration fighting communists. And, you know, from my vantage point, I'm not in agreement with Mormon theology, but man, would I love to have some Mormons as neighbors, because they're just, you know, they're great people no matter what their theology are. You know, the kids are wonderful. They do nice things for you. That they, you know, the emphasis on family is a big, huge traditional American value. They have a really good sense too of a tolerance and diversity within them, having gone through this whole persecuted period of their existence. I mean, 100 years, that's a long time. Why can't bygones be bygones? Why does this stuff still persist?
Well, I think that in the social and political realm, it largely has gone away. I mean, there isn't, as you noted at the outset, there isn't violence against Mormon missionaries when they go out now to the South and other places. And part of this is an increased rule of law in the country, and we don't allow for vigilantism the way we did in the 19th century. But it is, because Mormons have shed many of their social and cultural and political peculiarities, it means that they can be brought in to the broad American, you know, e pluribus unum ideal. But there are still theological differences. Although some of the 19th century theological particularities have been muted or cast aside by Mormons, there are still real differences. And I think that is the source of what we see, especially from conservative evangelicals, as they say, look, these people, they're not even really Christian. I mean, it's one thing, you know, if you're a Baptist or a Methodist or even a Catholic, there's been a kind of rapprochement with Catholics since Vatican II, although that's tenuous in some areas. But with Mormons, given their unique Christology, given their unique ideas about the afterlife and about the relationship of God and humans, people are wary of that and say, this isn't recognizably Christian, and we're not sure if we believe that America is a Christian nation, then we're not sure we want somebody who we don't think is a Christian to be leading that nation. I mean, there's all this stuff about Barack Obama's a Muslim, secret Muslim. I mean, it plays into some of that as well. It's mm-hmm. this nostalgia, this mythology of America as a Christian nation. What that really means is it's primarily a Protestant nation with some room for Catholics. So I think a lot of it stems from that and this continuing suspicion that Mormons aren't quite like us. I mean, Mormons are, the LDS Church is trying. They have a recent ad campaign called I'm a Mormon, and you find it on YouTube and all these other places where they're essentially trying to say just what you did. Hey, we're just like you. You know, we're different, but the same. And, you know, we're surfers and bikers and baseball players, and we do all those things too. We just go to a different church and believe a few different things. And I think that's what Romney is trying to play on, and what he was trying to accomplish in that speech. It remains to be seen just the depth, especially if Romney emerges as a front runner, and becomes the Republican nominee. My suspicion is a lot of conservative evangelicals, they're not going to vote for Obama, but they're just going to stay home. I mean, they just won't be able to stomach voting for a Mormon, even if he has, in some ways, impeccable credentials as an economic conservative. You know, people have some questions about how consistent he's been on other things. But even if he's their guy and proclaims a strong conservative agenda, I suspect a lot of evangelicals are just going to stay home.
Yeah, I have to add to the list that you had when you were talking about the I Am Mormon campaign, that we're surfers and everybody just like you. The Latter-day Saints also made an incredibly funny movie called Church Ball. I think that was the name of it, about a basketball league and churches. And, you know, it kind of... It pokes fun of Mormonism, but also just kind of the interactions in any kind of congregation, that it's, you know, you're not going to heaven on earth when you enter a church door, that there's going to be conflict and people are goofy and dumb and angry and all that kind of stuff.
We're just like you.
Yeah. And for me, this is, again, I'm really trying to wrap my head around this. You mentioned that a lot of evangelicals might just sit it out. And in my discussions back in 2008 and 2007, when Romney was picking up steam in the primaries, and I was surprised by a number of conservative evangelicals that I knew were just adamantly opposed to Romney. And I just kind of looked at him and I said, well, you know, we're not electing the Pope.
Right.
And for me, it was puzzling that if my faith is so weak that if there's a Mormon in the presidency, my faith is going to be shaken down to the roots of it, and I'll just lose all my faith. I wonder how strong my faith was to begin with. I'm wondering if people are going to sit this out, or if this is going to be one of these instances of the Kennedy moment where people said, well, I will never elect one of those papists with all their popery, and,
right,
you know, but he made it through. And after he made it through, he said, okay, Catholics are okay. And we had this moment with Joseph Lieberman when he ran as a vice presidential candidate. And I didn't see much concern of, well, we got a Jew in the
right.
White House. And, well, that okay. Everybody just seemed okay with that. So I'm wondering if America needs to go through this little growing pains, and to what extent that it might be a major factor in the upcoming campaign, as it looks increasingly clear like Romney will be the front runner, maybe challenged by Perry. There's always surprises going on here. But you know, so what are your thoughts? Is this a Catholic moment? Is this going to be a really big thing? Could this tip the election against Romney or what?
Yeah, it's hard to say if it'll tip the election against him. Like you say, it may end up being like Kennedy, that a lot of people make a big deal out of it, and then in the end, other things matter more, right?
The people
say, I'm not electing him to be pastor in chief. And there will be, I think it's very real that there will be a hardcore element that will sit it out, that say, I refuse to vote for him because I think this is a Christian nation, and I'm just not going to allow a non-Christian into that. I'm not going to support him for the chief position in the country. But I do think, you know, America is remarkably expansive. The logic of liberalism, the logic of pluralism is remarkably expansive. And the American story, as it continues to unfold, more and more groups get welcomed into the fold. And it's really, I think, a remarkable story of integration, of tolerance, of people finding that they can be neighbors with one another and be part of a democratic civil society together, even if they have fundamental disagreements about things that they care a lot about, like religion. And this might be that moment for Mormonism. I mean, you know, just like Catholics had paid their dues for a long time in American society, and they had built an intellectual infrastructure as well that allowed them to accommodate American democracy. Mormonism has done the same thing over the past 100 years and has built the infrastructure that allows it to be quite authentic when it says, you know, we're Americans just like you and we can participate in this democratic body politic. Will the rest of voters go along with it? I think that remains to be seen. But it just might be this moment, and we could look back on 2011 and 2012, just like we do at 1960. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that might be the case. That even if there will be holdouts, that this could be the moment where Mormons are sort of semi-officially welcomed in the fold and said, okay, you're part of the body politic. We don't agree with you theologically, but you're one of us, mm-hmm. and this is what it means to be American.
Yeah, this decade and perhaps this generation of Americans really might be, you know, working through these growing pains. We just elected an African-American president,
right.
And, you know, there's other indications of this. I, as you were talking, I was thinking about Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana, who is an Asian Indian, and he's became a Catholic and immensely popular amongst a number of people, including conservative evangelicals. And there's even been talk that if Romney takes the nomination for the presidential campaign, the vice presidential nominee would be Marco Rubio, a Cuban Catholic. And, you know, you sit back and you think, wow, we've really come a long way. And, you know, changing a lot of these stereotypes, changing these bigotries. It's always very difficult in a pluralistic nation when people with different ideas and values bump up against with one another. It's not going to be smooth sailing all the time. But I think what your work does extremely well is to highlight how this stuff has manifested itself over time and how things might well be changing.
And I do think you're exactly right to point out the generational aspect. Because younger evangelicals, people in their 20s and 30s, have a different set of issues that they care about, and they have a fundamentally different outlook on the world as an older generation that has preceded them, that came to power in the 1970s and 80s and really brought evangelicals into the GOP in a really strong way and shaped the GOP that way. And so younger evangelicals, they just feel and look at the world differently. And I think that's true of younger Mormons and younger Catholics, too. The overall and underlying religious landscape in America is changing. And denominational identities mean less than they did even 20, 30 years ago, certainly half a century ago. And that says something about the nature of America and American religion.
Well, Patrick, I think that is an excellent thought to leave off on. I want to refer people back to our website, www.researchonreligion.org, where you can pick up a link to the book Patrick wrote called The Mormon Menace. It's a wonderful read. It's very interesting. And I think, again, for the upcoming campaign season, it's highly relevant. So, Patrick, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.